Take your Bibles this morning, turn to the second chapter of Revelation. Revelation chapter 2. I'm going to read verses 8 through 11, just a short letter here, the letter to the church of Smyrna. Revelation chapter 2, verses 8 through 11. Follow along with me while I read. To the angel of the church in Smyrna, write, the words of the first and the last who died and came to life. I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich. And the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested. And for 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death. This is the word of the Lord. Let's ask God's blessing on our time in his word today. Father, we thank you for this word that reveals your heart to us, your being to us. We confess that it reveals to us all that we need, but we also confess that our hearts are so often dull and rebellious. And so we ask that by your Spirit, you would soften our hearts, open our eyes, so that we might see wonderful things here in your law, and then make our hearts more like the heart of Jesus, your Son, in whose name we ask it. Amen. This weekend saw several marches for life in Washington, D.C., and various other places too. Washington was the big one, but there were various other ones around the country. One of the Christian bloggers that I tend to read from time to time pointed out that not many of our news outlets covered these marches for life. You didn't hear a whole lot about the marches for life. You heard a lot, and still are hearing a lot, about the women's marches around the country. You're not hearing a lot about the March for Life. And I don't say that to begin a screed against the media, okay? I think it's dangerous to think that the media is our enemy, okay? So that's not my point in saying that this morning. But my point is simply to illustrate a fact of modern life in our culture. And that is that our society is opposed to the values that we stand for. Our society is generally opposed to the values that come out of the scriptures. And that simply makes sense. If you think about the world being in rebellion against God, as Scripture tells us it is, as you think about the effect of sin and the depravity of the heart that is at work in the society around us, it only makes sense that the world would hate what it hears in the Bible and the effect of the ethics that are taught us in the Scriptures and the hostility that we see in the world. Sometimes it is depressing, isn't it? Sometimes it gets us down. It gets us to begin thinking that we're in a bunker, you know? We're hunkering down with our like-minded friends and family and colleagues, and the world out there is coming to get us. And we begin to look back on previous ages of our country, perhaps, and we look back with nostalgia at the good old days, and we say it didn't used to be like this, or our country used to be better or more ethical or more virtuous. And that may well be the case in the short-term view of things. But the reality is, the world has always been hostile to the gospel. The culture at large has always been hostile to Christianity. But that's okay. That's what we were told to expect. Jesus told us to be prepared for this. He said, in this world you will have trouble. But he said, be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. And in other words, that's very similar to what he says here to the church at Smyrna. And I think through the church of Smyrna, it's what he says to us. He tells us it's okay. In this world, you will have trouble. Things will go poorly for you in this world, but it's okay because your hope does not lie vested in this world. Your hope lies in the next, the one that I am bringing with me when I come. Jesus is in control of the beginning and the end. Jesus is in control of the future. And because he controls all things, beginning, middle, and end, because he controls the start and the future, we can take comfort and we can maintain our testimony even in the present. That's what Jesus tells the Christians in Smyrna, and that's what he tells us too. Knowing that Jesus controls our future helps us maintain our testimony in the present. If you've been with us for the past couple of weeks, you know that we've started this series. This is now the second letter of the seven letters to the churches of Revelation. And our hope in this series is to remind ourselves what the mission of the church is. Not just the mission of Little Church in the Vale, but the mission of Christ's church, the mission of every local church, the mission of God's people throughout the world and throughout history. Which is really very simple. It's a very simple mission in terms of understanding. It's a little bit harder when it comes to working out, but Jesus gives us what that mission is right before he ascends into heaven. Do you remember what he said to the disciples in Matthew 28? He said, go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. He says, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I command you. Make disciples. That's the mission of the church. And I'm persuaded by several Bible scholars and commentators that I've read as I've studied the book of Revelation that in its essence is what the message of Revelation is. Be faithful in the mission. Be faithful in the mission. Be faithful in testifying to the truth of who Jesus is. No matter what happens in the world, no matter the terrible things that might happen in the society that surrounds you, no matter the horrible things that you see, be faithful to testify to the truth that Jesus is the King, that Jesus rules, that Jesus is returning. Testify to these things. Maintain your testimony. And just as that's the message of the book as a whole, I think that's the message of each individual letter that Jesus writes to these seven churches that represent the churches of the first century and that similarly represent churches throughout history, thereby representing also us. So this is Jesus' message to us. Know that I am in control of your future. And because I'm in control of your future, you can maintain your testimony in the present. That's what we're going to see as we work our way through this short letter this morning. Knowing that Jesus controls our future helps us maintain our testimony in the present. This morning we're going to talk about the church's exile, the church's endurance, and the church's hope as we look at these four verses. Exile, endurance, and hope. Look again at verse 9. Of this chapter. Don't worry, I'm going to come back and get verse 8. I'm not ignoring it. I'm going to come back and get it in a minute, all right? Let's look at verse 9. I know your tribulation, Jesus says, and your poverty, but you are rich, and the slander of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. The church's exile. Now, I thought a lot about what word to use to describe this part of the letter and to describe Jesus' words to this church, and I landed on this word exile for a reason. I think the Christians of Smyrna in the first century were experiencing a real exile of a sort, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. But beyond that, exile is a word that the New Testament uses regularly to describe the experience of Christians in this hostile world. Look at 1 Peter and look at various other places in the New Testament. You'll see that there's this habit of the Jewish believers, like Peter, to look back on the history of Israel and look back at that particular period where Israel was sent away from the promised land into the land of Babylon, where she was surrounded by foreigners who did not believe in the same God that she believed in, and she was outside of the land of promise, the place of God's blessing. And Peter looks back on that time in Israel's history and he says, that is a lot like what Christians experience today. We are outside of the place of God's blessing. I don't mean that we're in disobedience. I mean, this land is not our final home. America is not the promised land. The promised land is coming with Jesus when he returns. We are waiting for it. We're outside of the place of promise still. And we're surrounded by those who are hostile to our faith. We're surrounded by people who do not worship the same God that we worship and do not value the same things that we value. So Peter looks at that and he says, exile. That's a good way to describe the Christian life. I think that's true for us. It's as true for us now as it was for Peter in the first century. A fact that we often forget, you know. We often get surprised when the world doesn't value the same things that we value. We often get shocked when we hear of evil things happening in the world, when people that we have idolized are revealed as sexual harassers. We get shocked and surprised by it. When obscenities are used by people in high places, we get shocked and surprised by it. We get shocked by these things, but we ought not to be. We ought not to be shocked. We ought not to be surprised because we are, after all, exiles. We are not in the promised land yet. Right? The promised land is coming with Jesus when he returns. And so the New Testament employs this idea, and that's why I've chosen to use it for us this morning. And it describes the experience of the church in Smyrna very well, and we're going to see what I mean in here in just a second. Jesus says to them, in verse 9, that he knows their tribulation. So what we can say about the Christians in the city of Smyrna is that they were already experiencing some kind of exile. They were experiencing some kind of tribulation, some kind of suffering. We don't know exactly what that was. We're not told exactly what it was that they were enduring, but we can make some educated guesses based on what Jesus says in this verse. He says, I know your tribulation and your poverty and the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not. So let me explain to you what I think is going on here at the church in Smyrna. And in order to explain this, I first have to give you just a tiny bit of history about the first century. Is that okay? I know you didn't come here for a history lesson this morning, but I think we need to get a little bit of history in order to understand this document that was written 2,000 years ago. All right, so let me just give you a little snippet of history. In the Roman Empire, the Romans, as they conquered new peoples, as they went throughout the known world, conquering people group after people group, one of the things that they did, they learned from all of the successful empires that had gone before them. So they did something that the Babylonians had done. They did something that the Assyrians had done before them. The Greeks hadn't done quite the same thing because the Greeks are kind of unusual in history, but we're going to leave them aside for this morning. So what the Romans did that's similar to all these other people groups is they did what was called a god exchange. Okay, so in those days, people worshipped all kinds of different gods and goddesses. You know that, right? Roman gods, Greek gods and goddesses. And so as the Romans came through and conquered a people group, they made a deal with that people group. What they would say is, we will accept the god that you worship. And we will talk about your god to others. We will help you export your religion to other people within the Roman Empire. But we expect you to take our god for yourself as well. And they didn't specify one or more of the various gods and goddesses that they worshipped in particular, but there was one god that they insisted that every nation that they conquered worship. And that god was the Roman Emperor. Every nation that came under the sway of the Roman Empire had to worship an image of the Roman Emperor. That was part of their way of unifying the empire religiously, but it was also a way of showing the submission of the people group that they had just conquered. And so they would take a beaten bronze image of the emperor and set it up, and people were expected to burn a little bit of incense in front of this image, and that was the way that they worshipped the Roman Emperor. And this continued on throughout history. And the Romans did this with every single people group that they conquered, with one notable exception. There was one exception to this. And the exception that they made was as a result of the fact that after they conquered this particular people group, and they insisted that this people group worship the Roman Emperor, that people group rioted. They refused absolutely to do it. There were riots in the streets when an image of the Roman Emperor was trotted through the streets of their capital city. And of course, that people group was the Jews. The Jews steadfastly refused to worship an image of the Roman Emperor. Every other people group in the Roman Empire said, well, this is a pretty good deal. The Romans won't obliterate us, and all we have to do is burn a little pile of incense to a beaten gold or beaten bronze image of their emperor. No big deal. But the Jews had learned their lesson throughout history. That's why they had been sent to Babylon in the first place, was because of their worship of idols. And they learned their lesson well. They would worship no god but Yahweh. And so they absolutely refused to worship an image of the emperor. And so the Romans had this conundrum. They said, either we have to annihilate the Jews entirely, or we have to let them get away with not worshiping the image. And even the murderous, bloody Romans were unwilling to commit genocide, at least in that way. They were unwilling to exterminate the entire Jewish nation. And so they made an exception. The one exception to this worldwide policy that they had was given to the Jews. The Jews alone in the Roman Empire were not required to burn incense to the Roman emperor. Isn't that interesting? Well, fast forward a little bit. By the first century, Christianity is growing throughout the Roman Empire. There are little pockets of Christianity that are coming up everywhere where there are synagogues, everywhere where there are communities of the Jews, there are Christians Christian church is forming. And the Roman leaders, they just naturally assumed that here's this set of people who believe that they're following this Jewish guy from Nazareth. It must be a Jewish religion. It's some kind of strange sect of Judaism. And so we're going to treat them just like we treat the Jews. We will not require the Christians to burn incense to the emperor, just as we didn't require the Jews to burn incense to the emperor, because they thought of Christianity as a Jewish religion. That works out pretty well for the Christians, right? Except for one fact, and that is that the Jews didn't like the Christians. The Jews hated the Christians. You can see this in the book of Acts. You see it throughout the New Testament. Those who rejected Jesus as the Messiah hated the idea that other people liked to think of Jesus as the Messiah. And so at first they persecuted the Christians themselves, but then they kind of got wise and they said, you know, a better way to get rid of the Christians is to whisper a word into the ear of the local Roman magistrates and say, hey, you know what? Those Christians that you're giving a pass on worshiping the emperor, they're not really Jews. And so one of the things that started happening in the first century, and we know this from historians like Josephus and other writers from the first century, one of the things that started happening was that Jewish synagogue leaders started going to the Roman officials in their towns and in their villages and started saying, those Christians are not Jews. Stop giving them a free pass on worshiping the emperor. And so it was still up to the Roman authority, but in some places, those Roman officials took that to heart, and they started requiring the Christians to burn incense to an image of the emperor. And when, as is predictable, the Christians refused to burn incense to the image of the emperor, they had to suffer the punishment. That punishment took on various forms in various places. Sometimes it took the form of just the kind of formal censors, and sometimes it took the form of being kicked out of the trade guilds that they were part of. Sometimes it took the form of having their property seized. You read about that at different places in the New Testament too. Hebrews talks about it, people being impoverished because of their faith. Sometimes it took the form of being imprisoned or beaten, and in extreme cases, it could even take the form of being executed for the refusal to burn incense to the image of the emperor. So, with that little bit of history under our belts, we look at this letter that Jesus writes to the church of Smyrna. He says, I know your tribulation and your poverty, the slander of those who say that they are Jews and are not. They're a synagogue of Satan. Well, there are different ways to interpret it, but for my money, I think the most likely thing that was happening in Smyrna was what I just described. I think the Jewish inhabitants of Smyrna were denouncing the Christians to the Roman leadership of that city, and as a result, the Christians were being persecuted. And into that situation, Jesus says, I know the slander of those who say they are Jews, but are not. I want you to pause and just think for a moment of the impact of that statement. Here's Jesus speaking about a synagogue of Jewish people. And rather than saying, they are, you know, my kinsmen according to the flesh, which would have been a true statement, it's a statement that Paul makes in Romans. Rather than saying, to them belong the law and the promises, rather than emphasizing all of the great privileges that accord to being a Jew, Jesus says, they say they're Jews, but they are not. They are a synagogue of Satan. These are harsh language. These are harsh words from our Lord about these Jewish people. And the reason that Jesus is so harsh with them illustrates a very important point. It illustrates for us this truth that true relationship with Jesus is not based on any outward appearance. It's not based on any genetic makeup. It's not based on your lineage or your ancestry, right? True relationship with Jesus is not based on anything like that. True kinship to Jesus, true relationship to Jesus is based solely on one's trust in him. This is why in the Gospels, when Jesus is, do you remember the story? Jesus is teaching in his home, and the crowds crowded around him, and his mother and his brothers come to see him, and they can't get to him because the crowd is so big, and somebody says to him, hey, your mom and your brothers, sisters, they're outside. And Jesus looks around. Do you remember the story? And he says, who is my mother? Who are my brothers? The one who does the will of God is my mother, my sister, my brother. True kinship to Jesus is based on a relationship of faith. It's based on a relationship of trust in him. And so Jesus can look at these people who can claim descent from Abraham, and he says, those are not real Jews. Does that sound radical? It's the same thing Paul said in Romans, isn't it? Not everyone who is descended from Abraham is a child of Abraham. Jews are not those who call themselves Jews outwardly, but those who are circumcised in the heart. That's the whole argument of the book of Romans. And Jesus says the same thing. They're not really Jews. They are nothing more than a synagogue of Satan. Oh, that's sobering, isn't it? When I translate that idea into our modern world, one of the implications of that, it seems to me, is that anybody who thinks that they have a relationship with God because they go to church, or because their parents were Christians, or because they give money to the poor, or because they do good things, or because they look in some external way, or they do things that make them think of themselves as Christians, that is not someone who has a real relationship with Jesus. Not if that's the sole basis for their belief. Those who are truly related to Christ, those who have a reason to claim kinship to Christ, are those who trust him. Those who see his death and resurrection and put their faith in that and are related to him through faith. The Christians in Smyrna were experiencing this symbolic exile. They were being slandered by the Jews. It was typical in Christians for Christians in those days to worship in the synagogue. You know, if the Jews were amenable to it, they would allow the Christians to gather and worship in the synagogue. And they were certainly probably kept away from the synagogue in Smyrna. They were exiled in that sense from that. They were slandered. They were experiencing tribulation. And yet they were apparently enduring the suffering well. Jesus says, I know your tribulation and I know your poverty, but you are rich. Jesus says, it looks to everybody else, and maybe it even looks to you like you're suffering great poverty, but in reality, you're rich. You have riches that maybe you don't even realize. You have riches that maybe you don't even know about. Jesus reminds them that they are actually rich in what matters most. It makes me think of what the author to the Hebrews says to his readers there, Hebrews 10, 34, 35. He says, you showed sympathy to the prisoners and accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession and a lasting one. Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward, for you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what was promised. That's what the Spirit says to the readers of Hebrews. And I think it's a similar idea at work here. Jesus says, it looks like you're poor, but you are rich. Your endurance brings with it a great reward. You are rich in what matters most. As Jesus' followers, we must learn to see the world as it really is. And that can be hard, can't it? Because we get distracted, we get blinded by all of the many great things of life. And here in the West, it's even a greater problem than it is in some other places in the world, because we have so much. And we can be thankful for all the great things that we have. We can be thankful for it. It's not, you know, I'm not here to browbeat us for being wealthy Americans. That's not my point this morning. But we need to be aware of the danger that exists to become content with all of these surface things, to become content with a full belly and a warm bed and a TV that entertains us, and allow our minds to be lulled to sleep, allow our spirits to be lulled into sleepfulness. We need to be aware that these things are not what makes us rich. We need to be aware that there is a wealth that is greater and deeper and more lasting. Jesus wants to say to us, I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich. Will he say that to you? Can he say to you, in fact, you are rich, richer than you know? This was the church's experience. This was their suffering and their exile. But we see their endurance here too. We see their endurance, and we see the words of comfort that Jesus gives to them in verse 10. Look at what he says. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. Jesus here informs them of 7 realities regarding some upcoming suffering. By the way, just a little pause here, a little parenthesis. Wouldn't it be nice if Jesus said to the Christians in Smyrna, you've been enduring well, so you're going to be able to take it easy for a while. I mean, that's what I would want to hear at this point. But instead, what he says to them is, you've been enduring, I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich. It's about to get a lot worse. And that's what he says. But let's look at what he says as well. That's not all he says. He gives them 7 realities that are going to help them in regard to this suffering. First of all, he tells them that the devil is going to be behind it. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison. So the first reality that he confronts them with is that the devil is behind it. It might look like it's the slanderous, unbelieving Jews, or it might look like it's the murderous Romans or some other people group who's at the back of their persecution. But Jesus says, in reality, it's the malice of Satan that's working here. All right, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison. That's an important thing to keep in mind. John, for his part, is going to emphasize it again later on in this book of Revelation. Turn there, if you will, Revelation chapter 12. And see this, verses 7 and following. This is John's symbolic way of explaining what's wrong with the world, what's going on in the world. Revelation 12, verse 7 and following, it says, now war arose in heaven, Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon. He's going to tell us who that is in a minute. The dragon and his angels fought back, but he was defeated. And there was no longer any place for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. For they loved not their lives even unto death. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, he says, and you who dwell in them. But, look at this, woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath, because he knows that his time is short. Do you want to know? You want to know what's behind all of the wickedness in the world, either directly or indirectly? It's the malice of Satan. You know, I don't know about you guys. When I was younger, I used to hear about the stories of the persecution of the church in places like the Soviet Union or China or places. And then the stories of how when all was said and done and reporters could get in and find out what was going on, they found that the church had not been extinguished, but it had grown, right? The church in China had grown. The church in those former Soviet states had grown. I'm sure that when all is said and done, when we hear about what's happening in North Korea and Iran, we will find out that the church has grown, that Christians have done their work, that the gospel has gone forth with power. But I always heard those stories, and I thought, man, the devil must be really stupid, right? It seems like he would catch on after a while that the persecution that he means to hurt the church is actually spurring its growth. Why, wouldn't he catch on to that after a while? And I realized that the factor that I had not taken into account is malice and hate. Satan hates us. And he hates the gospel, and he hates Jesus. And hate is blind. Hate is blind. Malice is blind. The devil is not stupid, not by any means, but he is filled with hatred. And so what he does, he's blind to the effects of. Jesus tells the Christians in Smyrna, the devil is going to be behind it. But, he says, do not fear, because though the devil is behind it, here's the second reality, Jesus is in control of it. The devil is behind it, but Jesus is in control of it. We know that that's the case because Jesus insists that he knows everything that's going on. He tells them what's about to happen. He's the first and the last. He is the beginning and the end. He knows all of it. He is the one who's in control of it. Satan can do nothing apart from God's will. We know this biblically to be the case. I think of what Jesus said to Peter. Do you remember what Jesus said to Peter towards the end of the Gospel of Luke, right before Jesus is arrested and goes through his passion? He says to Peter, Luke 22, he says, "Simon, Satan has demanded permission to sift you like wheat." Do you remember? Satan has demanded permission to hurt you, to break you. Well, that's a scary thing to hear, right? Jesus said that to you. But he's demanded permission. Right? He can't do it unless he gets permission. That's what I hear there. He can't do it unless he gets permission. And it's the same thing with Job, right? Satan can't do anything to Job unless he gets God's permission. So, brothers and sisters, listen to me carefully this morning. Though the devil might be behind it, God is in control of it. Whatever the Christians at Smyrna were about to suffer, whatever you are about to suffer, be comforted. Though the devil might be behind it in some way, shape, or form, God is in control of it. All right? So two things so far. The devil will be behind it. Jesus is in control of it. Thirdly, a testing, a purifying of their faith will result from it. He says, this is going to happen so that you may be tested, there in verse 10. The idea being not that the devil wants to test them, to break them, but that through this they will be tested in the sense of being purified and strengthened. All right? A testing of their faith will result from it. Fourthly, there will be a limit to it. He's about to throw some of you into prison, he says, that you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have tribulation. Now, if you remember, one of the things we said about the book of Revelation is that because of its nature as apocalyptic literature, it takes numbers and it uses them symbolically. That doesn't mean that they're not at the same time literal. That's a mistake that we sometimes make when we talk about symbols. Something can be literal and concrete and also have symbolic value. So it may be the case that they were literally thrown into prison for a literal 10 days. But whether or not that was the case, we know that certainly there's also symbolic value here because that's the nature of the book. Number 10 in this type of literature always conveys the idea of a completion of judgment. And so Jesus says, whatever else is going to happen, that this suffering that you're about to endure, it will be limited in its scope. It'll be limited. And there's comfort in knowing that there's a limit to suffering, isn't there? We forget that. We forget that, don't we? We forget it when we're suffering. When we're suffering, we forget it. We think when we're in the midst of hardship, when we're in the midst of trial, we think that this is how it's going to be from here on out. I remember when we had newborns in the house. You know, those first couple of weeks when you have a newborn baby and, you know, you're sleeping in 1 hour segments or 2 hour segments. And I swear, every time, we have four kids, but every time I thought, this is it, this is my life now. I'm always going to be sleep deprived. I'm always going to be angry. I'm always going to feel like crying every time I go to sleep because I know I'm going to have to wake up in half an hour. You know, it's always going to be like this. That's just stupid though, right? It's not always going to be like that. There's going to be a limit to it. It's going to end. I can endure all kinds of things. I've chopped off fingertips accidentally. I've broken bones and had them set without any kind of anesthesia, you know. But whenever I get a cold, I shrivel up on the couch like it's the end of the world. I tell you, it's the truth. You do anything, any kind of physical trauma, I'm good. But when I get a cold, it's the end of the world. And I swear, every time I think to myself, this is my life now. I am going to be sick forever. I'm never going to be able to breathe again. What's the point of having a nose this size if I can't breathe through it? I don't understand. And I think it's going to be forever. I mean, we always do that with suffering, don't we? We think that it's never going to end. And so Jesus, so pastorally, reminds the Christians in Smyrna, there will be an end to it. A time has been decreed for your suffering, 10 days, and then it will be over. Therefore, they do not need to fear it. That's reality number 5. You don't need to fear it. It's limited. Christ is in control of it. Reality number 6, you don't need to fear it, he says, but that doesn't mean you're going to survive it. He says, you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death. Well, hold on. I mean, you just said you don't need to fear it, so what's this, you know, you may not survive it stuff all about? Again, we have to change our perceptions. We have to shift our view from this world to the realities behind it. Physical death, earthly death, temporal death is not the worst thing that can happen. It's not the end of the story. They may not survive it, number 7, but they can overcome it. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. I will give you the crown of life. 7 realities here. Firstly, the devil will be behind it. Secondly, Jesus is in control of it. Thirdly, a testing, a purifying of their faith will result from it. Fourthly, there will be a limit to it. Fifthly, they do not need to fear it. Sixthly, though they don't need to fear it, that doesn't mean they're going to survive it. And seventh, they cannot survive it, but they can overcome it. Why am I talking about all these things? Why am I going through these 7 realities? Because I think there's some important implications for us as we face suffering. Understanding, first of all, understanding the true cause of suffering, that it is Satan acting with the permission of our God, enables us to look with gentleness and charity on our persecutors. Or at least it should. We should be able to look at those who are harming us not as our enemies, because they're simply those who are being used by our enemy. We don't have to look at in the case of the Smyrnians, the unbelieving Jews or Romans, we don't have to look at our secularized culture. We don't have to look at those on the other side of the political aisle. We don't have to look at those with differences of opinion. We don't have to look at those of different religious beliefs as our enemies, though they may be causing us hurt. But we can look through the haze and see the truth that Satan is acting with the permission of God. Secondly, understanding that suffering will end, either in a cessation of suffering or earthly death, gives us hope. There will be a limit to our suffering, whatever it is. Brother and sister, I don't know what you're suffering this morning. There will be an end to it. I don't know what that end's going to look like. I can't promise you things, but it will not be forever. There's hope there. Understanding that Christ knows and will reward suffering provides motivation. He says, endure until the end, be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. There is reward for those who endure. We have to develop a theology of suffering that takes these ideas into account. We have to get past that popular idea in our culture that if you do right, if you follow God properly, you will never suffer. We have to get away from that. We have to do away with that. We have to understand that suffering is very often part of God's decreed plan in our lives. But when it is, it'll be limited, it'll be controlled by Him, and there will be a reward waiting on the other side. Not only that, but we'll have to understand that He endures it with us. And He's in control of it. Knowing these things helps us to endure. It helps us to maintain our testimony. Knowing that Jesus is in control of our future helps us to maintain our testimony in the present. And this leads us into our last point this morning, which is our hope. Our hope. Where do we get hope in the midst of suffering? Again, as we're doing with each of these letters, look at the way Jesus describes himself in the introduction in verse 8. He says, to the angel of the church in Smyrna write, the words of the first and the last who died and came to life. The words of the first and the last. Don't just gloss over that because you're used to hearing titles about Jesus. Understand that when Jesus describes himself as the first and the last, he is saying that for a reason to these Christians in Smyrna. He is communicating something to them. He is saying he is at the beginning and he is at the end. He's the beginning and the end. In fact, this is language that back in chapter 1, the Lord God Almighty, the Father, used about himself. And now Jesus appropriates it and uses it about himself. He is the first and the last. He was there at the beginning. He'll be there at the end. He knows our past. He knows our future. He's in control of all of it. Now you tell me if that would give you comfort in the midst of suffering, knowing that Jesus knows the end from the beginning. He knows how it's going to play out. It was meant to give comfort to the Christians at Smyrna. I would suggest if we don't find comfort in that, then the problem is not with the offer of comfort. The problem is with us. It's with our hearts. There is comfort there. Jesus is in control. He knows the future from the past. He knows and controls it all. Not only that, but he is the one who was dead and has come to life. He died and came to life. So what he is demanding from the Christians at Smyrna is nothing that he himself has not undergone. I died, he said. But that wasn't the end. It was limited, you see. I died and I came to life. And he's holding out the same thing to them. He's holding out the same thing to them. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. And then look at what he says there at the end in verse 11. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches, all of them, including us. The one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death. The second death. What is John talking about? What is Jesus talking about there? We're going to wrap up by looking at one other passage in Revelation chapter 20. You can turn there if you want, or just listen as I read it. Revelation 20, verses 11 and following, we read about the second death. It's sobering language. John says, I saw a great white throne. This is Revelation 20, 11. I saw a great white throne, and him who sat upon it, from whose presence earth and heaven fled away. No place was found for them. And I saw the dead, the great and the small, standing before the throne, and books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged from the things which were written in the books according to their deeds. And the sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and Hades gave up the dead which were in them, and they were judged, every one of them, according to their deeds. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. Listen, this is the second death, the lake of fire. And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death. It's horrific, isn't it? It's a horrific description. It's prepared by God for the devil and his angels, for those who deceive the world. And yet Jesus says that everyone whose name is not written in the book of life will be thrown there as well. And yet, back in our passage in Revelation 2, he says, to the one who conquers, he will not be hurt by this second death. It puts things in perspective. It's meant to put things in perspective, at least. We can endure suffering in this life for 10 days, knowing that there is a reward for us for endurance, and that by following Jesus closely, we avoid the eternal second death. That's Jesus' message to the Christians in Smyrna. He says, endure, endure. Know that I am in control of all things. I am the first and the last. I went there before you. I know the way. I died and have come to life again. I know the way, and I can bring you through it too. Knowing that Jesus controls our future helps us maintain our testimony in the present. How are you doing in persevering in the midst of suffering? And I say that all the time, knowing that the suffering we endure in our culture is nothing compared to the suffering that some Christians endure other places around the world. But that's not the suffering that we were given. That's not the burden that we were given to bear right now. How are you bearing the burden of suffering that you have been given? How are you enduring? Are you maintaining your testimony? Can Jesus say to you, I know your tribulation, I know your poverty, but listen, the reality is you're rich. Can Jesus say that to you? I hope he can.